Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Chris James. And don't forget the music, the baby fly. Okay, now I got a cat climbing my shoulder. Tonight's show is made possible because the Organic Man Coffee Trike keeps me going. Coffee is the lifeblood of my world. 4501 McPherson, the nectar of the gods, is available there from 6:30 a.m. until 7 p.m. If you're not in Laredo, you can always get your coffee at organicmancoffeetrike.shop. Sunday, July 16th, 2023, I believe I said 2003 the other day, it's 2023, that's this year, at 2 p.m., I'll be speaking at the McAllen Public Library, 4001 North 23rd Street in McAllen. I'll be telling the story of a flying disc that crashed in Mexico back in 1948, exactly 1 year after Roswell. If you'd like to attend, they're telling me that the room is kind of small. They're not expecting record crowds, but they can only get so many people stuffed in there. So if you'd like to attend, please contact them ahead of time and reserve a seat. You can contact them at 956-681-3000, or you can go to mcallenlibrary.libnet.info/events. That's libnet is libnet. That's library net, but it looks like libnet. I talked a bit about President Kennedy and what all went on behind the scenes leading up to the day of, as well as after, his murder. Conspiracy theory things. Well, how about some haunted activity after the car Kennedy was riding in was finally taken out of commission? The 1961 Lincoln was leased from the Ford Motor Company for $500 a year. Why they didn't just go ahead and buy the thing? Well, that's how the government works. Even though it was a lease, it received a six-figure upgrade from the White House. The car was rebuilt from a stock 1961 Lincoln Continental four-door convertible into an armored limousine with an armored sunroof that was not used in Dallas. The list price for the Lincoln was $7,347. And then they did $200,000 worth of work on it. When was the last time you rented a car and then dumped a whole bunch of money into it? That's 27 times more work done to the car than it would have originally cost. And it was rented. Why not just buy it? Nobody does things like that except for the government. What color was the car? Everybody thinks it was black. Most photos of Kennedy in the limo are in black and white. Kennedy had asked the Secret Service to paint the car midnight blue, and they did. Immediately after arriving in Parkland Hospital and getting the president into the ER, the Secret Service got busy washing the blood out of the car. You know, a standard crime scene procedure, a clean up the mess before the police look at it. They also wiped down the exterior so the car would look nice before it left Dallas. The windshield was replaced for some mysterious reason. After Johnson took over, the same car was still being used. Maybe that's why the Secret Service washed it off. Johnson didn't want to get any of Kennedy's blood on his hands. Richard Nixon also rode around in the same car. It wasn't until 1977 that the car was finally retired. By this time, the government could have bought the car and paid it off 100 times. It was modified a few times more, bringing the price to about $1 million. The limo was then returned to the owners and put on display in the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. People visiting the museum have seen a man in a gray suit standing next to the car. He vanishes as soon as they look at him. Who could this be? Kennedy always wore dark blue or black suits. Secret Service guys all wore dark suits as well. Nobody knows who this man in gray might be, but a lot of people have seen him just standing there next to Kennedy's car. He's not looking at the car, he's standing with his back to it, like he's showing it off or something. Maybe he was one of the men that worked on the car. Maybe he was the salesman who negotiated that $500 deal with the government, but people keep seeing him. In South Africa in 2004, there was a bizarre incident that kind of shook up a lot of people. In the middle of the night, a Renault Megane turned itself on and then began jumping backwards up the hill. The family in the house heard the sound of the engine revving up loudly, and they thought that somebody was trying to steal the car. They called the police, and the authorities showed up. They looked in through the window, and they could see that there was nobody in the vehicle. They opened the door, and they could see there was no key in the ignition. The shift arm was in park. I don't know for certain, but I would guess that they pulled the battery cable in order to get the car to behave for the rest of the night. The neighbors on both sides had heard the commotion, and they came to see what was going on as well. There were around 14 or 15 people who all saw this car acting up. The next morning, the car was hauled over to a mechanic shop for a look-see. The mechanic couldn't find any problems with it. Now the experts, they rushed out and they said that probably whatever was wrong, of course they didn't even bother to go look at the car. They sat behind their desks and made assumptions. They said the trouble was the starter cable was frayed, and this is what caused the car to start and then try jumping backwards into reverse, even though the police said it was in park. They also suggested that the owners of the car had been partaking of the grape. They were drunk. They didn't have anything to say about the police officers or the other folks who had shown up to watch this bizarre activity of the vehicle. It's funny how they ignore any facts that they can't shine a light on. The officers on the scene said the car was in park and the engine was revving as if somebody had their foot on the gas. The car had a mechanical fuel feed, so it wasn't caused by a short. This led to a lot of folks to believe the car was either possessed by some kind of a demon or it was haunted by maybe a previous owner. The car had been bought brand new by the current owners, so that couldn't have been it. Those of you around my age, see, this is what you have to look forward to as you get older. Those of you who are around my age will remember Dr. Death. The younger folks will just have to listen and learn about something that was going on back in the 70s and 80s. Jack Kevorkian was born May 26, 1928, in Pontiac, Michigan. He went to medical school and he began his practice in 1953. He had some unusual ideas on what a doctor should do. One being that he thought it was proper to conduct medical experiments on death row inmates just before their final date with destiny. He also thought it was a good idea to conduct medical experiments on them after the fact. In the 1960s and 70s, he worked as a staff pathologist at a hospital in Michigan and in Southern California. After retiring in 1982, Dr. Kevorkian devoted himself to his new mission in life, helping patients end their lives. People who were dying from terminal illnesses were being kept alive, but not really living, by machines and drugs. These people were slowly dying, and they were not enjoying it one bit. The doctor wanted to help them rush ahead and get over with it by inventing a machine that they could use at home, on their own, to end their suffering. Dr. Kevorkian used two methods when assisting ill patients who wanted to end their lives. These methods involved using his creations, the Thanatron and the Mercytron. The Thanatron enabled patients to administer lethal intravenous drugs into their bodies by injection. Hey, only the government's allowed to do that. When Kevorkian's medical license was suspended, he became unable to legally obtain the drugs needed for the Thanatron. This led to the creation of the Mercytron, which was the process of delivering carbon monoxide through a mask. Many medical doctors believed that such actions violated the most basic tenets of medicine, to make as much money as possible before your patient died. No, that's not it. To do no harm. Even though they do. The doctor rode around in a 1968 Volkswagen microbus. This was sometimes known as the death bus. He hauled his machines around, visiting his patients to help them along. He actually lived in the van for a while. He was more concerned with helping folks than making the almighty dollar, it would seem. Dr. Kevorkian died June 3, 2011, after helping something like 130 terminally ill patients get on with it. When my grandfather was dying with lung cancer, the doctors didn't want to give him any more painkillers because they said he might become addicted. He was forced to suffer the last few weeks of his life because they didn't want him addicted to drugs when he died. After the doctors went to see his patients in the next life, those with access to the microbus said they would see shadowy beings in the vehicle. Many began to speculate that these were the patients that Dr. Kevorkian had helped. When the doctor died, his van was at a pawn shop in Detroit. The vehicle received so much notoriety, it was sold in 2015, and it is currently on display in a paranormal museum. Just who bought the van? None other than Zach Bagans, who paid $32,500 for a Volkswagen that no longer runs and needed a lot of work. The interior was quite messed up. Why do you think the ghosts of patients Dr. Kevorkian helped leave this plane of existence might want to hang out in his old Volkswagen bus? Nobody ever died in the bus. They mostly died in their own beds at home. I would think that maybe, since he was the only doctor who was actually helping them along, maybe they decided they wanted to hang out with him, even in the afterlife. In Russia, Poland, Belarus, Ukraine, Hungary, and Mongolia, they didn't have cool cars like we had back in the 60s. Back in the 1960s, we had the GTO, the Roadrunner, the Charger, the Mustang, cool cars with huge engines. In the Soviet-run countries, they had the Volga. It was considered to be a luxury car, but then having any car was considered a luxury. At least that's what I have been told my entire life. If I'm wrong, let me know. I had a GTO. That thing was cool. It needed a lot of work, but it was cool. The Volga was kind of a boxy-looking vehicle. It came in a variety of colors. However, the black Volga became somewhat of a legend, if not a demon. During the 1960s and 70s, anyone walking along a road or a deserted street who heard the sound of an approaching vehicle would have good reason to grow anxious. The story about the Black Volga is familiar to many people in Eastern Europe and parts of Asia. The reason for this reaction was stories were being told of people being kidnapped by several men who would drive up in a Black Volga, grab some unsuspecting person, and speed away. The victims would never be seen again. Many witnesses told of seeing this happen. They would be in some out-of-the-way location, walking or sitting by the road. A vehicle would drive up, grab someone, and drive away. Some say a car would sometimes stop and ask a passing person what time it was. As soon as the man or woman came close to give the answer, the door would open and the person would be quickly drug inside. The witnesses said they never saw anyone inside the vehicle. Sometimes it was claimed that it would simply appear out of nowhere, kidnap someone, and then disappear as it drove off down the road. Although the brand of the car was always the same, some details of its appearance were described differently in different times and regions. Often it was said to have had white elements on the exterior, such as maybe white curtains or white wheel rims. In the latter times, some even claimed that the Black Volga had horns instead of side mirrors, adding to the demonic image of the vehicle. Occasionally, the car was said to be painted red instead of black. There are also various ideas as to who was driving the car. The most popular version is that it was KGB agents. Some believe it was being driven by nuns and priests, maybe Jews or even vampires. I have no idea why a bunch of nuns or priests would be kidnapping people, but keep in mind, the Soviet Union was run by atheists. The story of religious people driving around doing nasty things could have been put out by the government to heap derision on any and all religions. As the story evolved, some people said it was Satan himself behind the wheel. With the passage of time, the stories grew a bit wilder and a lot more prevalent. There are also several theories on why the people were being kidnapped. Many told that all the victims were children who were taken to facilities where their blood was drained in order to be sold on the black market to rich Arabs or Westerners. There were those who said Soviet upper echelon folks were to blame. Those rich old people who were approaching the end of their lives were desperate to live on, even at the expense of everyone else. Other stories were told of super rich people with kidney failure or other organ problems who were out hunting for young people in order to harvest their internal organs. Even today, as people discover they won't be living forever, actions have been taken to change destiny. It's not all that much of a stretch in imagination to believe that anyone who could afford a fancy car would probably belong to some secret organization that looked on everyone else as if we were there just to keep them alive. During that time, this particular brand of car was used by communist officials. Many people lived in fear of being prosecuted for their ideas and opinions because of the stories of frequent arrests. Soviet government would take any person who seemed suspicious to them, bring them in for questioning. After these questionings, not all were safely returned home to their families. A lot of them simply vanished. The Volga was receiving a lot of bad press, you could say. This was the reason why a distinct sound of a Volga's engine made a lot of people uneasy, even invoking panic and fear. You hear the car coming and you wonder, is it coming for me? Over the course of the Cold War, more than 100,000 Latin Americans went missing and became known as the disappeared. I should have said several hundred thousand. Between 1,000 and 2,000 people vanished in Chile, as many as 30,000 in Argentina, 60,000 in Colombia. They think maybe 6,000 in El Salvador and 15,000 in Peru. The guesstimate is that 25,000 people vanished in Mexico. People went missing in the United States, Canada. Every country in the world had this problem. The families of the disappeared began blaming those in power, and today it turns out that a lot of them were right. Mass graves are being uncovered all over the place, and usually in the southern countries. The bodies of the people who may have been grabbed by men or maybe something else, something driving a black Volga, have yet to turn up. As files are uncovered about secret police activities in Soviet countries, they only explain some of the mysterious vanishings of people over the decades. I remember Alec Guinness as Colonel Nicholson in the movie The Bridge on the River Kwai. I also saw him in The Man in the White Suit as Sidney Stratton. He was an accomplished actor and he starred in 67 movies, yet most people know him as Obi-Wan Kenobi from Star Wars. James Dean starred in 3 movies, which earned him enough money so he could pursue his real passion, which was racing. In September 1955, Guinness arrived in Los Angeles after a long flight from Copenhagen. He was to have dinner with Thelma Moss, an actress and screenwriter with whom he had worked several times, and they were close friends. The pair were turned away from a number of fancy restaurants because Moss was wearing trousers, which was a no-no back then. They walked along the street looking for a less formal place to have dinner. At the Via Capri, they were told there were just no tables available. They were booked solid. As they were exiting the restaurant, a young man ran up to them and asked if they would join him. He had a table with plenty of space. He was there alone. The young man turned out to be James Dean. I imagine Dean probably recognized Guinness since he had been in so many movies, and James Dean was trying to become an accomplished actor as well. Dean wanted to show off his new car, a 1955 Porsche 550 that he had named The Little Bastard. George Barris, a famous Hollywood car customizer, had done some work on the car for Dean. Guinness looked at this brand new vehicle, and he heard a voice in the back of his mind that he thought needed to be expressed. He said, "Please never get in it. You'll be dead within a week if you get into that thing." Well, exactly 7 days later, Dean and his mechanic, Rolf Witherich, were in a head-on collision, and Dean was no more. The remains of the 550 Spider were auctioned off by the insurance company. Even though the entire front end was smashed to a barely recognizable mess, the engine of the Spider remained unharmed and intact. Dr. William Eschard, a passionate part-time racer, purchased the 550 Spider and he stripped it down. He used the four-cylinder engine for the remains. He used the four-cylinder engine from the remains of the Porsche in his Lotus 9 chassis. Some Spider parts were 550 specific, so Eschert lent parts from the transmission and suspension to another surgeon named Dr. Troy McHenry, who was also a race car driver. They participated in the 1956 Pomona race with their cars that had the cursed Spider 550 parts inside. Everything seemed to be going okay. Eschert was pleased with the way the Lotus drove. Then, something went wrong. He wound up losing control and crashed. The doctor did receive some heavy injuries, but he survived the incident. The car was totaled. Midway through the race, Troy McHenry lost control of his steering wheel, and he also crashed. The accident claimed the life of the doctor. These incidents created a new buzz surrounding the Porsche 550, saying that it was cursed. People said the accident of Dr. Eschert and Dr. McHenry were caused by this curse. Both had used parts of the same 550 Spider in their cars, and that is why they were in harm's way. George Barris from Hollywood purchased the wrecked Porsche and had its, because of the famous owner's name, Barris displayed the car in various car shows in the wrecked condition to pretty much tell people you don't drive fast on the highways. People that would touch the Spider would get cuts and mysterious wounds that couldn't be explained. Somebody would reach over and they'd run their hand along the fender, and the next thing they knew, their fingers were bleeding, yet there were no sharp objects sticking out of the car. The curse of the little bastard spread like wildfire, and people discussed the topic at great length. Dr. Eschert made a documentary, and he showed the VIN number of the engine and other parts that he had removed from the Spider. The four-cylinder engine is still in possession of the family of Dr. Eschert. The rest of the car was sold to various people, but records are sketchy as to where they might be today. Recently, the transaxle used in the little bastard surfaced online. The VIN number was checked, and it showed that it was James Dean's vehicle. The four-speed transaxle was sold for $382,000. I thought I spent a lot of money on my truck keeping it on the road. Numerous accidents occurred involving the body of the Spider until one day in 1960, when the car was going to a safety exhibit in Miami, it mysteriously disappeared while in transit to Florida. Some say that George Barris had the cursed car hauled out into the desert and buried. Others said it was in a warehouse somewhere waiting to come back out once the legend of the curse had died down. In 2015, Sean Riley, a 47-year-old man, said that he knew where James Dean's car was hidden. Riley said that his father, who had been a carpenter, had taken him to a job when he was a child, and the client that they were working for wanted to have a wrecked sports car hidden behind a wall. Father and son worked to hide the car. As the two worked, the wrecked car gave Riley a cut on one of his fingers, and it left a huge scar. Riley also said that one of the men who wanted to hide this car was none other than George Barris. The Volo Auto Museum had Riley take a lie detector test, and he passed it with flying colors. Riley's story was the first real lead to the vehicle, even though Volo had a $1 million bounty out for the Porsche since 2005. Riley was never able to give the address of where this Porsche was hidden. The big question on my mind is, why was James Dean's car cursed? Where did it come from? Did he almost run over some gypsy lady who aimed one finger at him and said, "Flat as a pancake"? Any of y'all that remember Hogan's Heroes, you might remember that. How does a car get cursed? The spirit of James Dean could have gotten attached to the car since he told people that he really loved it. Would the ghost of Dean go so far as to kill other people just because they're using parts of his vehicle? Most folks who knew him said that Dean was an all right guy. Not like some Hollywood people who believed the world revolved around them, which it does after parties and they drink too much. When and where did the curse attach itself to the car? It must have been between the dealership and the night Alec Guinness saw the vehicle, because he said he felt something evil about it. December night 2002, police in Surrey, England, began receiving phone calls from multiple drivers who said they had seen a vehicle swerve off the road along the A3 highway. When the police arrived at the scene, they couldn't find any crashed vehicles anywhere. They searched the area more thoroughly, and they did find a maroon Vauxhall Astra, which was wrecked in a ditch. Inside this nose-down car, the police found the decomposing body of the driver. It was obvious that this crash had occurred long before that night, due to the state of the body and the growth around the vehicle. The police set the crash as having happened 5 months earlier, meaning that the people calling in hadn't seen the Vauxhall Astra veering off the road, or had they? The idea got started that the ghost of the motorist found in the car was trying to call attention to where he was sitting. He used the ghostly image of the ghost car to get the attention of motorists and draw them to his body. Instead of remaining trapped in this wrecked vehicle, he was now able to receive a decent burial. This reminds me of something that happened back when I was a firefighter. I was sitting at the desk, trying to stay awake, when a car came screeching to a halt next to the front door. A young lady came running in, tears streaming down her cheeks. She collapsed into the chair, and she told me that a car had just flipped over. Right in front of her, it rolled into the brush on the side of the road. I got the general location and hit the alarm. We rolled out the door. We drove the length of the road where the crash was supposed to have been. We flipped around and we drove back, slowly looking for signs of the crash. We made several passes. The road wasn't all that long, but there was no crash to be found. I believe it was on Red Bluff Road, just north of Clear Lake City in Texas, I think. I called dispatch and I told them it was a false alarm and we headed back to the station. The woman was still sitting there in the office, night quiet as shook up, but you could see the anguish in her face. I asked her to go over what she had seen. She went over the details of the story. It still sounded as if it had just happened and she had been there to witness it. I reassured her there was no accident on the road and that she should go home and try to forget about what she thought she had seen. Later, we got to looking at the logbook, and we found over the years there had been several fatal crashes in the same area, right where she had said she'd seen the vehicle flip over and disappear into the trees. All I can think of is she must have seen a crash that had happened months or even years before. In 1989, Stephen King released his 13th horror novel, Christine. The antagonist in that story was a haunted car that would run around the area killing people. Some say that this story was based on an actual event. As the 1964 Dodge 330 rolled off the assembly line, there was nothing special about this particular vehicle. There were no accidents in the plant where it was being built, and nothing bad happened as far as anybody could tell. Dodge built 76,400 cars, exactly like the one that became known as the Golden Eagle. Old Orchard Beach, Maine, bought one of the 76,000 cars, and they put it to work as a patrol unit. Back then, police cars came equipped with huge engines, so they could outrun just about everything available to the public. Back when I was a cab driver, I had an old highway patrol vehicle. It was faster than anything else in the fleet. It was also worn to heck and had dents and scratches and dings, and the interior was horrible. But man, could that thing go. Does it surprise anybody that I have held lots of different jobs? I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. The patrol car was issued to the station to be used by one of the regular officers. He drove the car for some time without any problems coming up. The vehicle wasn't assigned to just one man, but it rotated amongst the men on duty. One night, one of the officers who had driven the Dodge 330 went home after work, killed his family, and then himself. Everybody wrote this off as being a tragedy. Someone should have seen it coming. It happens all too often in law enforcement. I knew several agents who killed themselves over the years. I also knew several cops who did the same. Those who knew the officer all kind of blamed themselves for not seeing it coming. They should have recognized the signs somehow. They should have done something, anything, to prevent this tragedy. But everybody that thought about it said it was a total surprise. There were no signs of his having issues until it was too late. A few months went by, and officers drove the Dodge all over their township without any odd occurrences. At the end of one shift, another officer went home, killed his family, and then himself. He had also been driving the same unit as the first officer. A coincidence, everyone said. Two officers killed their families and themselves after driving one particular unit. It has to be just one of those things. Life is filled with bizarre activity. No sense in making claims of paranormal activity where there are none. Months later, the third member of the Old Orchard Peach PD killed his family and himself. The brass didn't want to admit there was a problem with one of their patrol units. It's just one of those things. You know, the men are working too hard, probably drinking too hard as well. Nobody would mention the word cursed or paranormal. It was a mere coincidence. None of the officers would drive the Dodge 330 after that. They said they would rather walk than drive the Deathmobile. People began saying the car was cursed, but nobody could say why or how. They didn't need an explanation to know there was something not right about this vehicle. Just because the officers refused to drive it, the car was still in very good shape, and it was decided to put it up for auction. The city sold the year-old car to Dr. La Rochelle, who had the black and white police colors painted over in gold paint. This was when the name the Golden Eagle came to be. One of my cats is climbing up on a shelf on the other side of the computer, and I was hoping she wouldn't knock the boxes over. The stories of the curse were hushed, and those involved told to keep their paranormal spooky stuff to themselves. The doctor owned the Golden Eagle for 7 years. During this time, it was struck by lightning twice, sustaining damage both times. The doctor sold the car to the fire department, who utilized it as a chief's car and for running errands. In 1983, the car was sold once more, this time to Wendy Allen. Wendy was happy to just get a vehicle at a very good price. It was still painted gold, but you could see where it had been hit by lightning and some of the wear and tear from running all over the county. When she purchased the Golden Eagle, Wendy Allen had been well aware of its reputation. Having spent a majority of her life in Old Orchard Beach, she knew the stories of how the police officers had killed their families and themselves. But it was just a story, right? One morning, Allen was taking out her trash when she noticed something laying on the hood of the car. This turned out to be the body of a bird. Finding no sign of how this creature had died, Allen disposed of the body, assuming it had died of natural causes. Over the coming weeks, more animals wound up dead near the vehicle. Allen found the body of a rabbit lying alongside the parked car. The creature appeared healthy with no injuries. she began attributing this death to natural causes. A week later, one of Allen's neighbors knocked on her door and told her there was a dead fox laying at the end of her driveway. Wendy began to think she was being targeted by somebody for unknown reasons. Somebody had a beef with her, but what it might be, she hadn't a clue. She loaded the dead fox into her car and took it to the local veterinarian's office for a quick exam. The cause of death was electrocution. There were no exposed wires anywhere near the driveway. How could the fox get shocked so badly away from any source of power? As more dead animals began turning up in her driveway, Wendy took them to the vet, only to be told that they had all been electrocuted. She began to suspect maybe the car had some exposed wires or something. The thing about DC power is it's not as dangerous as AC. A direct current, you can touch both battery terminals and get shocked, but it won't kill you. Not the same with AC, which you can get killed pretty easy from that stuff. But she thought it was the car wiring. Having double-checked that there were no exposed cables or wires anywhere at the front of her property, Allen took her Dodge 330 to the local mechanic, who also failed to find anything which might have caused the deaths of the animals. It was as if a lethal field extended out from the bodywork of the car, ending the life of any creature which ventured too close. Other than all the dead animals, Allen had not experienced any other issues with the car. She'd owned it for several months, and she used to drive herself and other people all over the place. One afternoon, she needed to run a couple of errands in a nearby town of Scarborough, and she invited Letta Bryant, the wife of the local clergyman, to join her. As Allen was driving along the highway, the front passenger door swung wide open. Before Allen could react, Mrs. Bryant began grabbing at anything in her reach as she slowly slid across the seat and out the door. Allen stomped on the brakes, only to feel the car speed up. Mrs. Bryant continued to scream in terror as her fingers released their grip on the door frame, and at the same time, the seatbelt popped open. She disappeared out the door onto the highway. Once the old woman was out the door, Allen found that she now could control the car again, and she brought it to a stop. Mrs. Bryant had not sustained any serious injuries, as the car hadn't been traveling all that fast. When Wendy offered to get her back into the vehicle, Mrs. Bryant pulled away from her, saying that that car is possessed, as she had felt cold, invisible hands pulling her out the door. She swore that she had been physically thrown from the vehicle. Following the incident, Allen once again took her car to the local mechanic, asking the man to inspect both the doors, the seatbelt, and the brakes. He informed her that despite multiple attempts, he could not force the seatbelt open, he couldn't get the door to pop open, and there was nothing wrong with the brakes. Allen repeatedly attempted to apologize to Mrs. Bryant, but she wasn't having it. This incident would lead to a lengthy battle between Allen and the church, which demanded that she remove the Golden Eagle from town, or else. Or else what? I guess they would say bad things about her. In the years that followed this event, two different children who were cycling past Allen's home, where the Golden Eagle was parked, were both struck by a vehicle and killed. Two separate occasions. Both died within sight of the parked car. This got the church congregation to demand that local authorities force Allen to remove the vehicle, believing that it was the cause of these children's death. The owner refused, arguing that she had the right to park her vehicle on her property anytime, any way that she wished. When members of the local church heard about the car's reputation, they went out and vandalized the car in an attempt to stop it from being used. The story goes that many of those who vandalized the car ended up being killed in various bizarre accidents. One member was struck by lightning and killed. 2001, Allen was working in her garden when she was confronted by an elderly churchgoer who told her if she wasn't going to get rid of the car, then she should at least have it exercised. Allen laughed and told this woman to go away. There's no connection between all of these deaths and the car. That was just crazy talk. The argument escalated to a point that the police had to be called in order to calm things down. They told the Karen neighbor there was nothing in need of an exorcism. The officers all refused to mention the three murder-suicides that were connected to the car. That was just old history. The following week, Allen was in her kitchen listening to a local radio station when a story came on the news that caused her to stop in her tracks. The old woman who had argued with her had been killed in a traffic accident. When Allen asked around about the circumstances of the crash, the description of the incident chilled her to the bone. The lady had been driving on a straight stretch of road, it was decent weather, when her car had unexpectedly veered off into oncoming traffic. An approaching truck filled with cargo bound for the grocery store was coming into town. The driver tried to avoid the car by hitting the brakes and swerving. His truck jackknifed sideways and the car went right under the trailer. The old woman's head wound up in the back seat. Witnesses to the accident all swore that it looked as if the car was accelerating just before it hit the 18-wheeler. This event only caused further bad feelings with the church, whose leader, Bernard Elliott, now encouraged open campaign of vandalism against the Golden Eagle. Attacks on Allen's vehicle and property became more frequent, as she found herself embroiled in a bitter court battle with the pastor. This came to an unexpected end in 2004 when Elliott was arrested on fraud charges involving church funds. Instead of going to court to plead his case, the pastor committed suicide while at home. His suicide was deemed just another death attributed to the Golden Eagle. In 2007, a young man was seen running his hands over the sides of the hood and the car before he went home and killed his entire family the same way that the three officers had done. 2008, 21-year-old Matthew Cushing was convicted of murdering three family members. Allen began to believe that the car was actually responsible for all of these deaths. When she suggested the car was linked to the killings, she was officially warned by the local authorities not to make such weird claims. 2010, two church members stole the Golden Eagle from outside Allen's home, driving it to the scrapyard in Freeport for disposal. When attempts were made to crush the vehicle, the area was struck by a mysterious power outage, preventing the car's destruction. Undeterred, the church members had the vehicle broken up into pieces, selling the parts to various businesses all over the county. When Allen discovered what had happened, she set off in pursuit of the remains of the vehicle. She obtained as many as she could before moving them to an undisclosed location. Despite Wendy Allen coming to realize that this car was cursed, she went about the state looking for the missing vehicle parts and taking them back to her house. One story says she did this to keep the parts together so that the curse wouldn't be spread out amongst other vehicles. Another story goes she was driven by her inner demons to seek out the Golden Eagle and try to put it back on the road. Now, the dates that I mentioned, they don't sound correct because Stephen King wrote that book, Christine, quite some time ago. That was long before 2010. Or maybe he wrote the book just based on what happened to the police officers. I've had a few pickups in my time that I would have sworn were haunted, but not because of anything I'd seen. The battery would just simply be dead in the morning for no apparent reason. Well, that happened to a lot of vehicles, whether they were haunted or not. The tires would go flat because, well, there were nails sticking out of them. Just common vehicle problems, but when you have an old work truck and you work on it a lot, you sometimes start to believe it's haunted as well. The man in the gray suit seen next to Kennedy's Lincoln is unknown. The ghost, it doesn't do anything, it just stands there and makes folks uneasy. The Renault Megane in South Africa acted up just that one night, but there were no further incidents reported after that one time. A Dr. Kevorkian's VW microbus may be inhabited by the patients who chose to end their suffering, and they were now hanging out with the doctor. Once more, they don't seem to interact with any of the people seeing them. Most are just shadowy shapes moving about the driver's compartment. The Black Volga, seen in the Soviet Union, is connected to hundreds of disappearances. Those who were pulled off the streets have never shown back up. They are still all missing at the hands, well, the doors, of the black car. Was it one car or several? Those who saw the vehicle did sometimes give different descriptions of the vehicle. Was it a real vehicle or some kind of a creature, a monster, an entity that was disguised as a car? How does a vehicle go about becoming cursed? James Dean's car was brand new when he went for that fateful drive. His death was not due to the car he was driving, but the guy coming from the other direction. Once Dean was dead, why were there so many unexplained deaths connected to the various parts sold to other drivers? Could the sudden release of all that energy have attracted something to the wreck that just didn't like people? Is the 1955 Porsche 550 Spider still out there waiting for its next victim? And if so, why? Why was the car suddenly causing so many deaths? The ghost car seen by the folks in Surrey, England in 2002 is something to ponder. People didn't see a ghost of a person, they saw the ghost of a car. Steel, cloth, a vehicle. This would imply that things just might have a lot more going on than bits and pieces of metal or plastic. The spirit may be manifest in shapes other than what they looked like when they were alive. What would make one thing come back as a ghost while other things just wind up in a landfill? Could the spirit of the driver have taken on the appearance of the vehicle? All those vehicles, the Dodge 330, aka the Golden Eagle, is the biggest mystery. The car was new when the old Orchard Beach PD put it into service. Just because it was driven to crime scenes and accidents wouldn't create the atmosphere of evil. The department had several vehicles, and they all behaved themselves. Someone must have done something to the vehicle between the time it rolled off the assembly line and it was driven by that first police officer who then went home to his family. I want to believe that some evil person placed a curse on these vehicles involved in all these tragedies. It had to have been intentional. Otherwise, any vehicle could somehow become cursed, leading to all kinds of nasty outcomes. Like Phil Connors said, don't drive angry. Hope you enjoyed tonight's show. If you did, spread the word around. Tell people they should be listening to Strange Things with Chris James. If you didn't enjoy it, why are you still listening to me? You should have turned it off by now and gone to listen to some kid unboxing his orders from Amazon or something. Don't forget, Sunday, July 16th, 2023, I'll be at the McAllen Library at 2 p.m. talking about that Mexico crashed flying saucer. The phone number is 956-681-4000. 3000, or you can register at the mcallenlibrary.libnet.info/events. Until next Saturday, this is Chris James for Strange Things. And I grabbed the wrong mouse again.